The Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Present.
Mariani, present. Vice Chair Frazier?
Present.
Frazier, present. Representative Johnson?
Present.
Johnson, present. Representative Edelson?
Present.
Edelson, present. Representative Feist?
Present.
Feist, present. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins? Representative Hollins? Representative Hewitt?
Present.
Hewitt, present. Representative Cleavorn?
Present.
Cleavorn, present. Representative Long?
Present.
Long, present. Representative Lucero?
I'll put the hat on for roll call.
Lucero, present. Representative Mueller?
Mueller, present.
Mueller, present. Representative Novotny?
Present.
Novotny, present. Representative O'Neill?
Present.
O'Neill, present. Representative Pinto?
Present.
Pinto, present. Representative Poston?
Present.
Poston, present. Representative Raleigh?
Raleigh, present.
Raleigh, present. Representative Vang?
Present.
Vang, present. Representative Zhang?
Here.
Zhang, present. Representative Hollins? That concludes the roll. There is a quorum present.
Thank you, clerk and members. Today we have Laura Sparkman, who's pinch hitting for us. I have been in communication with our committee legislative administrator, and it sounds like she's on the mend. So we look forward to welcoming her back, I believe, next week. But Laura, thank you for helping us today. Members, there is a quorum that's present. This hearing is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations and Response to the COVID-19 Infectious Disease Pandemic Requiring Public Health Exercise of Social Distancing. Citizens of the public can view Minnesota House Rule 10.01 on the Minnesota House website. You can also visit the committee page on that website for information about accessing this hearing versus streaming video, as well as instructions on how to participate in public testimony. Members, we haven't adopted a minutes in quite a while, and I really appreciate the members' patience for that. We do have some minutes, though, that we can't adopt today. There will be a bit of a hole with some minutes going back a week. I think you all understand, and I appreciate your patience with it. But at this point, I'm hoping our Vice Chair Frazier can move the minutes of January 28th, January 29th, and February 2nd.
Chair, I will move those minutes.
Very well. The minutes of January 28th, 29th, and February 2nd have been moved by Representative Frazier. Discussion? Hearing no discussion, all in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 All same sign. Motion prevails. And the minutes of January 28th, January 29th, and February 2nd have been adopted. Members, today's agenda is simple in number. We have, and today is our second meeting this week under the chair's theme of investing in law enforcement excellence and accountability. Today we're going to hear about two bills, one that has not been introduced yet, but will be introduced this afternoon in floor session. And that's a bill that I'm authoring regarding police policy manual funding and standardization. And then the second part of the hearing, Representative Frazier will be moving House File 593, before us regarding standards and training board required to revise peace officer conduct standards. So members, the first part will be an informational hearing. Obviously, we don't have the bill in our possession, and so we can't officially move. And so it will be my intention, however, to have, when the bill is introduced, be under consideration for an eventual omnibus finance bill from this committee. And so today is really meant to be an informational hearing, and we do have some testifiers that will come and share some wisdom with us, and hopefully we can enter into a good discussion with them. So members, as we discuss ways in which our local law enforcement, public safety, emergency responder agencies can enhance their excellence and increase their accountability to Minnesota laws in serving the public, as we explored a week or two ago, an increasingly diverse public in many, many ways across a very big state, it seems to me that the state should constantly look for ways to assist that ongoing development. We could do that, I believe, by providing financial help to cover the costs of updating law enforcement agencies' policies as they adjust to changing laws, for example, changing federal immigration rules or recent judicial decisions, or to new evolving conditions in their communities and new expectations from their citizenry in their jurisdiction. One way in which all professions do that is to connect with emerging best practices in other similar jurisdictions, in this case, either across the state or across the nation. These are often, in turn, informed by research and experiences in the field and preferably are evidence-based in nature. An efficient way, I believe, for a state to see that this happens, this constant evolution and updating work happens, is to have an agency in the state that can do the legwork, if you will, of identifying experts who can work with local, in this case, local LEAs, law enforcement agencies, to access best practices and offer advice on how to use this for updating their policies and procedures. And I think that as an incentive, especially for LEAs that are struggling with resources, is to have the state provide funds for access to such experts. There is much work, admittedly, to do in details in the bill that will be introduced, so I won't be moving the bill today, as I mentioned, we can't anyway. But I wanted to open up the discussion here on what the needs, what the benefits, and what things to look out for would be on this issue so we can entertain this as part of our finance omnibus bill later. The bill language before you is quite simple. It creates a grant program at the post board for this purpose that I spoke of and identifies broadly what characteristics the board should look for in a qualified public safety policy and training expert to provide consulting services to local LEAs. And so to enrich the conversation and inform ourselves, I've invited representatives from law enforcement, including the Pulse Board, to share their advice and their expertise with us. And I have three testifiers that I'll call forward. First, I have Sheriff. Oh, and there's also, before I forget, there's also a letter that was submitted by a Greater Minnesota sheriff or chief. I think he's a chief. Should be a part of the record. And at some point, I'll call on Representative Johnson, who may want to comment on that letter. So let's start off with Sheriff Troy Heck, Benton County Sheriff's Office. On behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, Sheriff Heck, if you can come forward. And I hope I'm pronouncing your last name correctly.
Yes, you are. Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you all for the opportunity to talk to you. Just briefly about me, I've been with the Benton County Sheriff's Office for 26 years now. The last six of those, I've been the sheriff here. I've worked in a number of capacities in the sheriff's office. In 2008, the Benton County Sheriff's Office adopted the Lexapol policy system as part of the implementation throughout the state of Minnesota through the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. At the time, I was assigned the job of implementing this system in our agency. So we've had this system for over 12 years now, and I believe it's truly done remarkable things to enhance the services that we're providing to our citizens. Some of the things that I've seen over the last 12 years that I believe it's brought to us is first, standardization. The policies that we receive from Lexapol through our subscription are assembled by a group of subject matter experts. And what their job at Lexapol is to go through national best practices, comb through case law, comb through federal law and state law, and come up with policies that are defendable, are doing the right thing, are instructing our staff how to be the best law enforcement officer they can be in our current environment. I think that, to me, it just makes a lot of sense, given especially the size of our agency, it makes a lot of sense to pay someone who can do this at a very high level and produce excellent policies, rather than have myself or one of my staff try to reinvent this wheel. Frankly, with all the other responsibilities we have, I don't have the time to also try to do all the research and come up with these national best practices. And it just really makes a lot of sense to me to have Lexapol do that for us. And over the last 12 years, I think they've done a really excellent job for our agency and for the other sheriff's offices throughout the state that are using this. Standardization also means that as my deputies interact with other deputies that are our neighboring agencies, because we're all on the Lexapol policy system, we're all basically playing from the same sheet of music. There might be minor differences here or there, but if we need to help each other, we all kind of understand that we're on the same page and we're not going to have any conflicts because their policy is vastly different than my policy. It really aids in that smooth transition between agencies and really aids in that intra-agency cooperation. As I've looked at these policies over the last 12 years, I've developed, I think, three themes that I've seen come out of all of them that kind of form the basis for what is at the heart of all these policies, and that is focus on public safety, focus on officer safety, and focus on building community relations. And through those three focuses, it really sets a tone for, again, the direction that we want to point our law enforcement agency to make sure we're doing the best we can for our citizens. Another advantage I see to the Lexapol policy system is that it's scalable. The policies are written so that they are pertinent and applicable for agencies of all sizes, whether the agency is a metro sheriff's office that has hundreds of employees, or the agency is maybe a small sheriff's office in the northwest corner of the state that has just a handful. These tenants are there to apply to all these agencies, and with a modest amount of work on the front end to customize and tailor these policies to your agency, you come away with a very robust and a very nice system of policies that helps guide your employees through a multitude of different situations that they're going to run into. You're able, through the system, to add in policies that apply to you. For instance, maybe you have a bike patrol or a canine program. There's policies for that. And if you're an agency that doesn't have those, you don't have to have them in. So it's really a holistic policy system that works well no matter what size agency you have. In my experience, the system is also very user-friendly. Like so many other things these days, the policies are stored online. So if you have an internet connection, you can get to the policies. You don't need to go back to the office to find the policy manual and search through it, the paper, page after page. It's stored online. You can access it. My deputies can access it on their squad computers. They can access it on a mobile device through an app that Lexapol has. Or, of course, at their desktop computers, they can also access it from my office. The policies are well organized. They're searchable. if I wanted to find all the policies that have use of force in them, of course, like everything else, I type that in the search bar and it spits out all the policies to me that have the word use of force in them. So it's very easy to find the information. The policy system has a nice and robust group of features on the back end for managerial operations so that myself or my other administrators can go into the system and we can check to see, are all of our deputies, have they acknowledged all the most recent policy changes? It's important to make sure everybody is up to date, up to speed. We can track that. We can make sure they're staying abreast of all the changes. And we can also track their training progress on these policies. And that brings me to what I think is one of the biggest advantages that the Lexapol policy system brings, is that training. The Lexapol policy system has what they call daily training bulletins. Now, all policy systems throughout the state, regardless of who generates them, they're very content dense. I mean, these are really thick books. There's a lot of information in there. It covers a lot of topics, and it's very difficult for anyone to read through that very dense policy book, remember and recall all that stuff if you only see that information maybe once or twice a year. The daily training bulletin system presents each officer with a daily reminder of a policy or a portion of a policy. So it takes them about 5 minutes at the start of their shift to go through this daily training bulletin. The structure of the bulletin is such that it presents you with a scenario. Some of them are actually based on real world events. It has a discussion point about that scenario. It displays the policy that they're training on or the portion of policy. And at the end, it has an analysis about how that policy applies to that particular scenario. Once the deputy finishes reading that, they're presented with a question to test their knowledge. Once they pass that question, that daily training bulletin is done, and now they can move on. The reason why I think that's critical is today, peace officers are called upon to make critical decisions, sometimes with little time to process what all the possible options are or what all the consequences might be. In these high-risk, low-frequency situations, officers have to have a thorough working knowledge of what their policy and directives are so that they are doing what we expect them to do. The daily training bulletins go through these policies and help remind officers every day what these policies are. Now, while these daily training bulletins cover virtually the entire policy book, it focuses mainly, it focuses primarily on these high-risk, low-frequency events that really require us to have that policy down pat and automatic. So I think, that is really, to me, the critical plus to the Lexapol policy system, is that we're not only presenting our staff with good policies that are pointing them in the right direction, we're training them over and over again as to what they are so that it becomes automatic. So just to summarize my comments again, I believe that Lexapol presents well-researched, well-written policies that can be adopted by agencies of any size with a reasonable amount of effort, that the policy system is user-friendly and provides these critical ongoing training, daily training bulletins that equip peace officers with the knowledge they need to serve the people of Minnesota. With that brief overview of my thoughts on Lexapol, I'd be happy to field any questions that the members of the committee may have.
Let me unmute. Terrific. Thank you, Sheriff Hack. I've got several questions, and I suspect the other members will as well. What I'd like to do is hear from the other two testifiers, and hopefully if you're able to hang around. If not, let me know, then we'll do questions and have a conversation. I will say a little prerogative of the chair that I am I did look through some of the Lexapol manuals in preparation for today, and also, you know, glanced at different manuals of policies, you know, from local law enforcement, and there's just a lot of information there. I mean, I can certainly see, I mean, there's a thoroughness to it, which I think is appropriate, but I can certainly see. For me as a layperson, you know, just the difficulty of being able to get through all that in a really smart way And so it seems to me any system that can help us, help anyone do that would be good. I also know that from speaking with several law enforcement experts over the years that on this issue of training, that there's a, I believe, a misconception that once you train the person like once, the person's trained. You know, it just doesn't work that way in any profession or in life in general, you know, that there is a building of habits and comfort and almost like a muscle memory kind of you know, analogy in terms of constantly exposing, being challenged, being offered different scenarios on a given particular principle. So I'm really intrigued by one of the things you shared relative to, in this case, a platform that offers that. I suspect there may be some other platforms as well, and hopefully that'll come out in our conversations as we go forward. So thank you again for your testimony. Oh, really quick, Sheriff, how big is your department?
We have 29 sworn staff, including all of our staff, sworn and non-sworn. We're about 80 people.
Okay. Thank you. Looks like you didn't. On my end, there was a freezing that went on. All right, very well. Let's move on. Thank you again, Sheriff. Next, we'll hear from Chief Jeff Potts, Bloomington Chief of Police, on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. Welcome to the committee, Chief.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the members of the committee. Just to be clear, I'm now retired as the police chief in Bloomington and have assumed the role of executive director at the Minnesota Chiefs Association. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing us a few minutes here just to speak today. Minnesota Chiefs Association, representing more than 300 chiefs across the state, supports this concept. As the chair said, it's not quite in bill format yet, to offer training and policy development funds. We support the ability for agencies to opt in to a grant program like this. As was mentioned, it won't duplicate a lot of what the sheriff spoke about, but there's a lot of value in consistency and as well as the training bulletins that are offered by this particular program. Although we know there are significant startup costs and ongoing costs associated with a partnership like this, and because of that, we feel it is left best to the agency to determine whether or not they participate in a program like this. We want to make sure the committee knows that moving to this legislation would not necessarily lead to policies being exactly the same from one agency to the next. I think Sheriff Heck would even agree that his agency at 29 sworn and nearly 80 is different than a police department that has one officer. And while they still may adhere to best practices, we think it's important for those agencies to do policy development in partnership with their community. We call that the co-production of policing. It's a fairly new concept that it's important to let agencies develop their policies with their community instead of it being a exact policy across the state. Now, there are certainly some policies that need to be more consistent than others, but our association believes that policy development should definitely be done in partnership with the community. What Chief Arredondo does in Minneapolis may be a little bit different than what Chief Bolt does in Mineota, and just need to recognize that in this legislation as we move forward. Mr. Chair, that concludes my comments today. Thank you for the time.
I guess I better stop muting myself. I got halfway through my my appreciation of your testimony. Thank you for your time. Hopefully you can hang around. I suspect there'll be some questions. I think there's some real interest in this issue of co-production and the making sure that our policies are aligned, not only with good, research standardized policies, but also matching up with local conditions and communities. With that, members, I'd like to move on to hear from Chief Kelly McCarthy, who is Chair of the Pulse Board. Chief McCarthy.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members of the committee. I believe Sheriff Heck really said it best, and I don't have a lot to add to his testimony. I would say that I am, full disclosure, a big fan of Lexapol, and I've introduced it into two agencies now. And what I have appreciated about it is exactly what Chief Potts was talking about, is that I was able to tailor it to the communities that I was working in. I was able to send out draft policies and get community feedback and then make my changes from there. And I really appreciated having that framework without me having to reinvent the wheel. But I think it's important for members of this committee, so I can just kind of bring it home, is since I've been at the Post Board, every policy that groups have brought to this committee asking for the Post Board to have a mandatory policy on are contained within that Lexapol policy manual. So if nothing else, it might end up in less work for you and the committee. So I'm happy to stay around for any questions.
Very well, thank you, Chief McCarthy. So let's open up for questions. Feel free to use your hands indicator, and I'll wait to see if there are any questions. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani. I've actually been a member on here besides, I believe, Representative Novotny as well. I've used Lexapol. It's a good program. The biggest concern I have is the size of it. Almost bigger than a medical manual. It's right now, my former department's Lexapol pages is 612 pages. Years ago, when I started law enforcement, policy manuals were guidelines. The officers had discretion, but the policies and the policy manuals have gotten so big, it's no longer guidelines. It's this way or the highway type deal. And it's gotten so big, the officers can't even understand them. That's why they've had to do the training part of it every day, which is actually good. But I can share one experience I had with the training module. Yes, the policy is going to be tailored to that department, and we were going through it, and I end up failing the training module. I went back and looked at it, and looked at our policy, looked at my answers, and Lexapol failed because they hadn't they didn't use the updates that our department had put in place. So it's got to be real careful that they're not teaching the wrong policies that your department have. And we brought that up. We finally got that fixed, but it's an issue that can happen. So you have to be real careful on that. And I'm just concerned about the size of the policy manuals have gotten, and they're to the point now where they have more consequences on the policy side of it than actual violating state statute. So it's one of the issues I have. And I remember when my department went on it, and Chief Bolt's letter mentioned some of the issues that he has with it when he looked at doing it, using it in his department. When my sheriff's office went to it, our chief deputy was on the committee that was going through it and going through it. They literally spent, I believe it was 9 months, going through that policy manual before we even started getting to the point where we were going to adopt it. That's one person working for 9 months to do that. And we're not a large department at the time. We had probably 18 to 19 sworn officers. Now you take some of these small cities like Minota, where it's a two or three, where Chief Bolt is at. I think it's a three-man department. You take that chief or one person away for 9 months. That's not possible in those small departments in order to get them set up to make them more towards their city and their community and the issues that are going on there. So it makes it hard for them to actually make their policies for their community when you do something this large. Lexapol is a good thing, but it's not for everybody. And I know the way the bill is written, I went through online and Googled and searched and searched and searched and searched and searched. Other than you might as well name LexiCool because they're the only ones that qualify, which I think is the wrong way to do this. It's just like the Department of Transportation when they do bids for road construction projects. And I'm going to use the example of a $7 million bathroom in my district. The way the bids were written out for them to people to work on it, nobody that lived in that in that area within a 20-mile radius of that project could even bid on it because the way a bid process was started. And that's doing the same thing. I've looked up on the internet and there's some other good companies out there that do fabulous work, some even here in Minnesota, but the way the bill is written, they can't even consider being considered. And I'm also concerned by setting it up this way that it's a one where the states start mandating what policies they can have and what company you can have. When is the state going to come in and say, this is the policy for your community? You have no options. You have to use this. I don't care if it's take it or you have nothing type of place. I think these policies should be able to be more set up what the community wants. The cost of LexiCool is expensive, especially in the initial setup. There's no question about that because to go through 612 pages of policy to tailor it to your small 1-, 2-, 3-man department there's not the manpower to even do it. So that's my concern on this. I hope you understand that. And I think Chief Bolt's statement is right. A statewide policy fails to appreciate the difference in agencies as regards to size, structure, and resources. I do have trouble with this. I like the concept, but I don't want to make it instead of a community policy. The more and more we go down this road, we're getting into the state is running our police departments, and it should be community led. If the state's going to start doing this, maybe this. I don't know where we're going to go. We're going to end up with a state police department instead of a community police department. Where the people that live there actually know their community.
All right, thank you, Representative Johnson. You raised a number of issues. So let me just say very quickly that I certainly would welcome an opportunity to work with you and others around language that can address a number of these issues. I don't think you can't be too careful, particularly on that last issue. I think part of what we try to do in our state is to keep that a right balance. With the state's, important duties, as well as those of our local law enforcement agencies. The current language doesn't have a mandate in it, either in terms of participating or, adopting a particular policy. But if there are ways to strengthen that language, I am certainly open to do that. I am struck by Chief Potts' sharing of the co-production framework that apparently is taking more and more hold in our law enforcement agencies, which I think speaks to a number of your issues that you raised. And I think Chief McCarthy also raised those issues, and I think Sheriff Heck has some experience with that as well. I do want to make sure that other members get to ask a question and or make a comment. So before I turn to my testifiers to respond to anything here, let me just call on Representative Otney. Representative Otney.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And just briefly, there are other policy groups out there. We had originally done LexiPol, and as Representative Johnson stated, it is an onerous task to get through the initial setup. Every week going through a couple of different policies and knocking that out. We'll say what, by the time you're done, you know your policy manual really well. We did switch over to a different one called Power DMS right before I retired. Same layout, but one of the advantages I think about Lexapol is it's guided by Gordon Graham, and anybody that's ever sat through a Gordon Graham presentation, it's a good example of how law enforcement should be. So, and then going to the mandatory policy, just in the little time I've been on public safety, I think about the mandatory policies that we've already added on. I sat through two audits of Post Board when I was in charge of training, and just putting together the mandatory policies that you have for Post Board right now takes up quite a bit of time. So it's a slippery slope, I suppose, but something we need to keep in mind. And that's all I have to say.
Okay, very well. Thank you, Representative Devani. I'm wondering if any of our testifiers wish to offer any comments or advice or other things that we might be thinking about as well as we explore this possibility.
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yes, please, Sheriff Heck.
Yeah, I don't want to sound like I'm going to come across as a Lexapol policy salesman. I swear they're not paying me anything to say these things. The comments about there being a time investment is correct. There is an investment in time that goes in on the front end to make sure that your policies are set up properly. And I would also agree with Representative Novotny that you definitely know your policies by the time you're done with this. And I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing. You can, in the Lexapol policy system, you can make it as voluminous as you want, or you can trim it down to just, this required Post Board policies. You have the option of including these policies or not including them. And by no means am I here to say that Lexapol is completely without problems. I think any IT-based system has its issues, and you're going to run into those. And for me, the important part is that this, whatever system is chosen, be thorough, complete, and have that training component. I think those are the key things that if someone were asking me what needed to be identified in a future policy system, those are the three things I pick out.
Very well. Thank you, Sheriff. I'm wondering either you or Chief Potts or Chief McCarthy, one of the things that we don't address in the draft before us, and it has to do with a number of you have already, adopted, participated, and used, it's probably a better language, a platform, whether it's Lexapol or Power DMS, I think one of the things we'll need to think about if we move forward with this is what do we do with those departments that already are using something? So any advice? Obviously, you're already using it, why should the state, participate? But I kind of suspect that there's still an important role for the state to continue to support, your use with this. But any words of advice, relative to that issue, I'd appreciate it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll weigh in on that question if you'd like.
Please.
Mr. Chair and members, I think one thing is for the community to know that the acquiring a software system or package like Lexapol, as has been mentioned, takes some time, several months. But also, there's a significant startup cost that, as you mentioned, there's probably agencies who have already spent those dollars. I'm familiar with one of our member cities, City of Corcoran Police Department uses this, a department of about 10 officers. Their annual costs for maintaining that are in the neighborhood of $3,500. And so I think one thing that's going to be important in the future, I'm not certain you're going to be able to go back and reimburse for the startup costs, but moving forward to attract more cities to do this, I think including the startup and the renewal costs will be important to bring more agencies on board and keep those who are currently using it.
All right, very well. Thank you, Chief. All right. Well, thank you. I don't see any other questions or comments from members. Thank you for everyone for allowing the chair to vet this idea out. There's still some work that needs to happen on it, and Representative Johnson, I'd love to work with you to make sure that whatever language we come forward, if we do it, that we're addressing some of those concerns that you've articulated. So again, thank you, Sheriff Heck from Benton County, Chief Potts, who is affiliated with the Chiefs Police Association, recently retired Bloomington Chief of Police, and Chief McCarthy for being with us here today. Look forward to continuing to working with each of you on this issue. Thank you much. With that, members, we're going to go on to the second part of the agenda, which is House File 593, and Representative Frazier, you're up.
Thank you, Chair. Do I need to make a motion to move this once we're done?
You would be strongly advised to do so.
I would like to make the motion to move this to the General Register.
Very well. Representative Frazier moves House File 593 be referred to the General Register. Representative Frazier, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Lee Johnson, and other committee members. House File 593 will require the Post Board to prohibit a peace officer from affiliating with, supporting, or advocating for white supremacist groups, causes, or ideologies. I think this is a timely bill. As we all remember, on January 6th, we all watched in horror as our nation's capital was stormed by a mob. The mob insurrection resulted in 5 deaths and caused Congress to delay the certification of the presidential election. There have been numerous arrests over the past few weeks connected to the events on January 6th. What we're learning is that dozens of the participants were members of white supremacist organizations and active or retired members of law enforcement. As the investigation of the Capitol insurrection continues to unfold, we have learned that one of the participants killed during the insurrection was an Air Force veteran and QAnon follower. There have been 2 Virginia police officers arrested, as well as 2 military veterans arrested in connection with the insurrection. In addition, there are dozens of ongoing investigations being conducted by law enforcement agencies around the country to find out whether their own members participated in the deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Now, many of you may know Congress recently released an unredacted version of a 2006 intelligence assessment by the Federal Bureau of Investigation titled White Supremacist Infiltration of Law Enforcement. The report had multiple conclusions, but I would like to highlight one in particular. The report concluded that although white supremacist groups have historically engaged in strategic efforts to infiltrate and recruit from law enforcement communities, current reporting on attempts reflects self-initiated efforts by individuals, particularly among those already within law enforcement ranks, to volunteer their professional resources to white supremacist causes with which they sympathize. I can tell you that's very concerning, that being the case. And I also point out, most recently, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said the type of domestic terrorism seen at the Capitol is one of the greatest threats to the U.S. right now, echoing the findings of a 2020 Homeland Security report. In addition, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has ordered a staggered pause of operations across the entire U.S. military over 60 days so commanders can review the handling of extremism among their ranks. Now, here's why this bill is important for our communities. It is necessary for law enforcement agencies to have the faith and trust of all Minnesotans in order to effectively operate and perform their important public service to communities all across our state. A licensed peace officer affiliation with, support, or advocacy for white supremacist groups, causes, or ideologies is patently inconsistent with each licensed peace officer's duty to protect and serve each and every Minnesotan with equal vigor. A licensed peace officer's affiliation with, support, or advocacy for white supremacist groups, causes, or ideologies is highly likely to cause a heightened level of distrust among Minnesotans who come from communities where there are already fractured relationships between the community and police. Now, I don't believe House File 593 is going to solve all our problems. I believe it's a small step in the right direction, but I do believe it's a very important step in the right direction for our state. With that, Chair, I'll yield to the testifiers.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Frazier. And I do see 3 testifiers, Mr. Justin Terrell, Minnesota Justice Research Center, Angela Myers from the Minneapolis NAACP, and Amber Jones from the Minnesota Council of African heritage. And so we'll take them in that order. Mr. Terrell, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Vice Chair Frazier. I'm also joined by Dr. Katie Remington Cunningham, who will go over some data that we've brought to this body today. My name is Justin Terrell. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Justice Research Center. Our organization is a 501c3 nonprofit focused on research, education, and policy. We believe that our work is designed to transform the justice system to make it more humane, effective, and operate with the public's trust. Today, we're here to, at the invitation of Representative Frazier, we're here to offer some of our preliminary findings from our Trust in Policing report that we'll be putting out at the end of the month. And like I said, I have my research director, Dr. Katie Remington Cunningham, here to go over some of those findings. But first, I just want to say, just echo some of the comments that have been made already, that recent events, you know, from Charlottesville to the murder of Ahmaud Arbery to George Floyd, the killing of George Floyd and the unrest that followed and the events on January 6th, all prove that we have a problem in this country, specifically with white nationalists targeting police and utilizing recruitment tactics and trying to infiltrate and get intel from those bodies. We have a problem with trust. I spoke to a couple of officers before I decided to make these remarks today. And one of the stories that I heard was a young man who I mentioned last time I testified in front of this body who was killed through community violence. And the officers on the scene tried to revive him. There were community members there who were saying that he was actually doing more harm. What does it mean when our community can't even trust the police to try to save the lives of victims of community violence? That tells you that we have fallen very far from a standard of trust that is needed to do this work. It's the responsibility of the bodies who govern police, that govern police, to interrogate threats to the standards of law enforcement and propose solutions that build trust. This requires courage. I would just want to be clear, interrogating white supremacy is not easy for our institutions, given the gross racial disparities that they produce. But in doing so, will reveal a shameful and terrible patterns of behavior that have produced the unrest and calls for liberation we see across the globe today, calls that started here in Minnesota. But like it or not, it is your job to do so. People need you to interrogate this issue and do whatever you can to fight against the number one domestic threat in our country, which is white nationalism. We believe doing so will build trust. And we prepared just a summary of some of our preliminary findings from the report that we're producing. And I'll pass it to Dr. Remington Cunningham to speak on those findings.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Cunningham. Please state your name for the record, and please provide your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Justin, for that introduction. My name is Dr. Katie Remington Cunningham, and I am the research director for the Minnesota Justice Research Center. And I just want to talk sort of briefly about our work on trust in policing, which, as Representative Frazier mentioned, is really timely work. So my background, I have a doctorate in developmental psychology and education and have studied trust and concepts, relational concepts like that, for a long time. And to trust is human. Psychologically speaking, we are wired to be trusting. And it's a critical and important relationship between communities and public service entities like police. And so I want to think about, when we think about trust, we also think about beyond just trust between individuals, trust in systems and in roles. So digging into the data on what that trust looks like, since 1993, Gallup has conducted a survey on public confidence in policing, and trust has hovered between somewhere around 50 and 64%. And this past year, that number dipped below 50%. So for the first time in 27 years, the majority of the surveyed population do not trust the police. And when we look at data like this, it helps to dig a little deeper into this data to look at the data disaggregated. And what we find is that this trust and confidence really varies depending on the race of the population surveyed. So since beginning these surveys, Gallup has found persistent differences between Black and white Americans. And as of 2020, that difference was the largest it's ever been, with 56% of white adults reporting a great deal of trust and confidence in police compared to just 19% of Black adults surveyed. So what this looks like closer to home, a recent poll conducted by the Council for Minnesotans on African Heritage, which Amber will probably talk a little more about, demonstrated that in Minnesota, we have a higher trust overall in police, but that gap remains. So 81% of white Americans felt they could trust the police always or most of the time, and only 51% of Black Americans felt this way. So with this data, we dig into the reasons for these differences, and we understand that centuries of historical inequalities, inequities, and injustices have really limited the ability of many to trust the police. And we understand, too, as Representative Frazier mentioned, that there's a large issue here, and the relationship between policing and white supremacy is really as old as our system of law enforcement. But we focus today on the explicit role of white supremacy in policing as a barrier to the development of trust. And as it turns out, incidences of police engaging in white supremacist hate groups and acting on and explicitly expressing these white supremacist ideologies really abound. So I want to talk about a report. Georgetown scholar Vita Johnson really dug into some incidences in which police officers, including high-ranking officials, were found expressing overtly racist beliefs and also direct connections to white supremacist hate groups. And she found this existed across 49 states and over 100 police departments, and that's just since 2009. So she goes back to the history of this, but she also points to really more recent examples in places like Florida or Louisiana of officers appearing in photos, giving Nazi salutes, supporting white supremacist tattoos, and even attempting to explicitly recruit members into the police force from a local KKK chapter. In Minnesota, she touches on incidences in Rochester, in Minneapolis, in Burnsville, highlighting the nature of this problem closer to home. And these are only examples in which there were scandals or they garnered public attention and outcry. So this does not include data on everyday complaints that might happen of incidences like this. And so as Representative Frazier mentioned, as it turns out, there's not a lot of data on this, but the data that we do have is actually coming from the FBI. So we have to rely on our intelligence agency to tell us that this is a problem, and they have for over a decade. So they've been warning of this danger since 2006. And also in 2015, so nearly 10 years after this first intelligence report, they continue to find and warn evidence of directly linking police officers to domestic terror groups and white supremacist groups, and we still have no policies in place to prevent this. So this is a problem for community and a problem for police. And I think that's important when we think about this sort of two-way street of trust. So I'll just close by saying that trust is important also because a large body of research in the field of criminal justice demonstrates that we're actually more likely to obey the law when we believe our system of policing is legitimate and when we have trust and confidence in our police. And in order to have trust, we need transparency. And I'm not the only one that says that. In fact, the International Association of Chiefs of Police, among other law enforcement organizations, has advanced this concept of what they call procedural justice as a really critical strategy for building trust and legitimacy in communities. And one of the four pillars of procedural justice is transparency. So we need transparency on affiliations and ideologies that directly affect the ability for a police officer to do their job with legitimate trust from community. So I'll end there, and we're going to really report in a couple of weeks with a lot more detail on this, but we really appreciate you all giving us the time to chat.
Very well, Dr. Cunningham. I look forward to seeing that report. Mr. Terrell, I think we can move on to the next testifier for now, but please, if both of you are able to stick around for question and answer, that would be greatly appreciated. So next we have Angela Myers, who is president of the Minneapolis NAACP. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Myers. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Frazier, for having me. My name is Angela Rose Myers. I am the president of the Minneapolis NAACP, which stands for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And we were established in 1909. The Minneapolis NAACP was established in 1913 and has been serving the Minneapolis community for over a century. Our mission is to secure the political, educational, social, and economic equality of rights in order to eliminate race-based discrimination and ensure the health and well-being of all persons. A major part of our mission that we fight for is actually rooting out white supremacy. In 2006 and 2015, the FBI has warned of white supremacists in law enforcement. These reports validate community suspicions and community histories of police ties to white supremacist organizations. Two-thirds of African Americans do not trust or look unfavorably on police departments. These reports tell us that the police departments are being intentionally targeted and infiltrated by white supremacist groups. This should be a concern for police departments, government entities, and community. As the insurrection of January 6th showed us, white supremacist groups are ready to violently attack the very foundation of our government. Naming and removing white nationalists, white extremists, and white supremacists is necessary. It is a necessary step that needs to be taken in order to regain the trust of our community. Lack of trust in police is directly tied to lack of trust in our government. And by taking actions to root out white supremacy in police departments, we can also take steps to root out white supremacy in our government. White supremacy, white supremacist ideologies have no place in our government, have no place in our country, as they do not reflect the values of regular day Minnesotans. So by not recognizing the destruction and prevalence of white supremacy in our police departments and in our state right now, it calls into question the competency, the legitimacy, and the authority of our elected officials, our government, and our police departments. So it is crucial that we name white supremacy, that we condemn white supremacy, and that we stand against overt racism and white supremacy today. I will leave with the committee a list of resources and references to the FBI report in 2006 and 2015, as well as links that have proven white supremacists have proven and exposed white supremacists in police departments across the country. As mentioned earlier, there have been exposed from FBI investigations police linkings with white supremacist groups in over 40 states and 100 police departments. And I'll leave those links with the committee below. So thank you for your time, and thank you for having me.
Thank you, Ms. Myers, for being with us today. And hopefully you could also hang around in case there are questions or clarifications from members. Next, we have Amber Jones from the State of Minnesota Council of African Heritage. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Jones. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, Vice Chair Frazier, and members of the committee. My name is Amber Jones, and I serve as the outreach coordinator for the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, one of our state ethnic councils. So we thank you, the leadership of this committee, for the dedication to this work. I'm here today, obviously, to testify on HF 593, by providing more research the council has conducted in the past year as it relates to policing. So in August 2020, just months after the murder of George Floyd and the subsequent uprising, the council partnered with the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley and Prosperity Now to design a nationwide poll with an accompanying Minnesota poll on various reforms to policing. This poll surveyed 500 adults in Minnesota with an additional oversample of 500 Black Minnesotans. In this poll, as has already been stated earlier in testimony, it shows that 81% of white Minnesotans felt that they could always or most of the time trust the police, while only 51% of Black Minnesotans felt the same. So that is a 30-point gap. And obviously, there are many reasons why this gap is so large. And we have a wealth of data that shows how Black Americans have been over-policed, over-incarcerated, brutalized in so many ways, as well as the systemic ties between modern American policing, and slave patrols pre-abolition. And I know that your committee has been going extensively into historical data, so I won't go too much into it, but I just thank you for all the work that you all are doing to really understand the root of this issue. And so as we look ahead, additional reform proposals that we polled in the specific report signify that there is a desire for Black Minnesotans to see efforts to increase trust in the community between police by implementing reforms that increase accountability for peace officers and also increase familiarity with them, among other things. And some of these reforms do include residency requirements, so requiring police officers to live within the city or town in which an officer serves. That's 80% of Black Minnesotans supported that proposal. Liability insurance requirements at 73% and independent civilian oversight review boards at 68%, just to highlight some of the things that we did poll in this report. However, when we look at instances like what happened on January 6th at the Capitol, and seeing how many of those who participated and those arrested were current or retired law enforcement officials, when we see some of the things that we have endured in recent incidents throughout our country and state, as well as the different pieces of data that have been referenced in testimony, this should be a signal to our governing authorities to really assess how entrenched white supremacy is within law enforcement entities. We cannot talk about reform. We cannot talk about diversifying police forces. We cannot talk about making progress in our justice system if we don't address this issue, because it is deeply poisoning and plaguing our systems. I just actually read today in the news that an officer in Louisiana who is Black, he actually took his own life. And before he did that, he talked deeply about his experience in the military and in law enforcement and how some of these ideologies really affected the way that he could show up in the workplace. And so this is a really important issue that we should really take seriously. And we are definitely in support of these conversations about how is a state that we can really address the issue, because it will remain a critical barrier in building trust in Black communities if it's not addressed. So I just thank you again, Chair Mariani and Vice Chair Frazier, for authoring the bill, and just members of the committee for your time and commitment to this conversation. I can definitely say that within the community, there's a lot that we are carrying right now as we are dealing with all the multiple issues when it comes to the pandemic and what's happening in our state and our country. And so we just thank you so much for your commitment to this conversation. We have submitted our data from the poll to the committee today, and we are always welcome to return to discuss it in further detail, especially as you start to consider additional proposals through legislation throughout the session. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. And the chair will make sure that all committee members will have access to the data that you've submitted. Thank you for that, and thank you for the work of the Council of Minnesotans of African Heritage. Representative Frazier, let me just quickly turn to you. I know there's a couple of amendments here, and so I'm wondering whether you want to advise that we do the amendments first and then open up for discussions about the overall bill, hopefully including your testifiers, or do you want to do questions now and then do amendments later?
I'd advise we do the amendments first.
Okay, very well. So, members, there is an A1 amendment, and who's offering that amendment?
Mr. Chair, Rep. Lucero will offer that.
Representative Lucero moves adoption of the A1 amendment to House File 593. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier and testifiers. I think the conversation on white supremacy is a very serious one and a very concerning one. And I agree that it has no place in our public. It has no place in society, let alone our law enforcement or any employees of government or anywhere, right? Employee, non-employee, anybody. It doesn't have any place. And it is very dangerous and harmful to other fellow citizens of this great state and country. But it doesn't stop there. I have a concern of more than just white supremacy. Those that might affiliate, associate, be organized with, promote, and a list of those, which is what my amendment seeks to do. The amendment reads to expand and not focus on just white supremacy, but also to focus on international or domestic extremist groups that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has determined supports or encourages illegal or violent conduct. And from the website from the FBI, I have several examples of those. They include international violent extremist groups such as Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, Hezbollah. If people are engaged or affiliated with those, I would be very concerned, or am very concerned. Radical environmentalist groups, eco-terrorism, we've seen numerous examples of that, of criminal lawbreakers violating private property, destroying private property, and I would not want any law enforcement or anybody to engage or associate with such violent radical environmentalist groups. Continuing on the list of the FBI, they have animal rights fanatic groups. Right, we've seen these fanatics that believe that animal lives are worth more than human lives, and they're dangerous liberation terrorists. I recall at the U of M several years ago, some criminal animal rights fanatics, they broke in and they released a bunch of I don't know what it's, rats or ferrets or something to that effect into the wild, and they all just got eaten by snakes and owls and stuff, and a violation of private property rights. Anarchist extremists like Antifa, we certainly don't want people affiliated or associated with Antifa, criminal lawbreakers and violent extremists, and the list goes on. And members, so I would hope that there would be the interest in expanding those groups that were concerned with affiliation, promotion, and ideology. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. There is an A2 amendment to the amendment, and who is offering that?
That would be Representative Frazier.
Representative Frazier moves adoption of the A2 amendment to the A1 amendment to House File 593. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So listening to Representative Lucero's comment, there are many ways that I agree that I wouldn't want some of those violent groups in the ranks of our law enforcement. What I will say, though, it is very important that we maintain the white supremacy language within this bill. As you heard from the testifiers and as you heard from myself as well as I presented, this is about building trust within the Black community. And a large part of that is addressing the issue of white supremacy. What we learned from the Capitol insurrection is that the other groups that you name, those groups have not been identified as groups that tried to overthrow our government. Those groups have not been identified as groups that have historically, or at least within the last decade or so, are making intentional efforts to infiltrate our law enforcement groups. So I just want to make sure we focus on what the clear and present issue is, but I absolutely do not disagree with addressing other groups as well. So therefore, my amendment to your amendment would maintain the language of the original bill as drafted, but it would include, it would adopt your amendment, and it would also include a definition of white supremacy.
Very well. Discussion. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a couple questions then to the author of the amendment to the amendment. When I'm looking at line 1.4, I think that there's a mistake here. So it reads on line, so 1.4 of the amendment to the amendment, page 1, line 2, delete everything after line and insert, quote, 10, comma, before the period, comma, insert. And there's no end quote. So I'm not quite sure what, when I put that in comparison to the my amendment, it clearly doesn't make any sense. So I'm just hoping you can clarify.
I'm going to request that we get, I'm sorry, Chair.
No, I was about to say, I think we're going in the same direction, Representative Frazier, and perhaps we should call our legal counsel to help us through this.
Yes, Chair, that's what I was going to say.
Very Thank well. And,
Mr. Chair, this is Jeff Diebel.
Yes, Mr. Diebel, please.
Yes. So the amendment will achieve Representative Frazier's objective of having the underlying provisions of the bill maintained and adding the clause that Representative Lucero has asked. So it would be both provisions would be in there. We engrossed the bill with the two amendments, and the language does work. I think this is a tricky business when you're trying to amend amendments, because you have to put instructions in to both amend the amendment and then amend the underlying bill as well. So it doesn't look like we're used to seeing things, but by shifting that, we delete line 9 and we put in line 10 in the amendment, and that shifts Representative Lucero's language down to the end of line 10, as opposed to replacing what Representative Frazier had proposed in his bill. So I hope that explains things, but we have run the test, and as far as the reviser system, and it does accomplish Representative Frazier's objective.
Mr. Debo, when I saw the amendment, I was a little thrown too, and you're absolutely right, you know, that amending amendments is technically complicated, involves technically complicated construction. That's why we have folks like you to work on those and then explain those to us. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Debo. Far be it from me from arguing or disagreeing, but I just want to resubmit for consideration. I believe that there's a quotation that's missing after 10, because the way it's written right now, the comma before the period, comma insert, would actually become part of the bill language. I strongly believe that there's a comma or a quotation missing. Additionally, the reference before the period, there is no period that I can see, so I'm not sure what period is being referenced. But again, if a fix is needed, it possibly would potentially be a technical fix.
That's correct. Mr. Debo.
Mr. Chair, the missing quotation is actually on line 1.5. That matches up with the one before 10 on line 1.4. So that's the pair, and then there's another pair on 1.5. And so what we're doing, we're putting in an instruction to amend the underlying bill. So that's we're not putting that into the text of the bill. We're putting it into the text of the amendment, and that's why it's in a quotation. So again, we have run this language, and it does come out that if both amendments are adopted, it will be both clauses included in the system. So the reviser should have things in order when these documents are presented to them after the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Debo. Important to have that on the record. Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's why elected officials should never disagree with our very competent counsel. So then I guess I would have a question then for the amendment author. So when I'm looking at the language, I would normally agree, and I think this is, you know, I don't have a disagreement with defining white supremacy, except for this. So my question is, when I'm looking at it, you include ideology. So white supremacy is obviously dealing with race. But in included in your definition, you have ideologies that, and then I'm skipping some words to help punctuate this. Ideologies that promote religious bigotry. Why did you choose to include religion when you're talking about race?
I don't think.
Representative.
Sorry, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Representative Lucero, thank you for pointing that out. I don't believe that white supremacy is only relegated to race. White supremacy is a supremacy over all things that aren't white. So that is why I included religion as well.
Very well, Representative Lucero.
Okay, so all things that are not white, well, I don't know what color religion is, which is what my concern is. I mean, religion can be any. Betty can believe it. So that clearly doesn't make any sense. But, and here's where part of my next question for the bill or the amendment to the amendment author would be. So we haven't had the opportunity, unfortunately, to meet in person yet, to form a relationship yet. But so you don't know very much about my background. But I was married in a mosque. My wife's side of the family was Islam. And so we're married by an imam. And the fact that all my in-laws are of the Islam faith, when I'm reading this language, as you have written, religious bigotry, I do know that Muslims, they strongly profess there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. That to me seems like it's a very definitive statement. And if I were to say, which is what I believe, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and the only God, are those examples of religious bigotry? Because one could simply and very easily interpret it as an extremist or bigoted or narrow-minded or however, you know, some of these languages are used. And then if somebody is attending a mosque or a church and they believe they're sincerely held religion, that their God is the God, why would that not be considered bigotry per the clear language of your amendment?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair. No, I do not consider the fact that someone is practicing their religion or believing in their faith to be bigotry. Representative Lucero.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, then, Mr. Chair, just for clarity then for the committee, what does if making a statement or a profession of faith of one's tenet of their faith and saying that the other person is wrong and having a dogmatic belief, if that's not it, what is religious bigotry?
I believe when you're taking, sorry,
Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Lucero, to me, the bigotry would be if you are using your beliefs to take actions in a hateful way toward another group based on their beliefs.
Very well. Representative Lucero, we're kind of pushing the clock here, so.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then I won't want to ask you more questions, but I'll put forward, I think, Representative Frazier, he said that to me, what bigotry means. Well, this isn't if this were to pass and become law, it's not a matter of what you and I believe. It's a matter of how the corporate interprets it, how the court interprets this language. And so we need to be very clear. And I don't think the language is very clear right now, because bigotry, as Representative Frazier just said, in his opinion, has to do with action. But I don't think it's just action. I think it's beliefs or statements can easily be wrapped up in this language, because it's very vague. It's very vague, and that's what concerns me. And for this reason, Mr. Chair, I would hope that we don't adopt this and just allow for an opportunity for it to clean up language. Again, I'm not opposed to defining white supremacy as you're attempting to do, but I think it's short-sighted to include religion as part of a definition of race.
Fair enough, Representative Searle. I would share with members that and this is part of the a large part of the reason why we have committee hearings, because occasionally a court will look for legislative intent. That legislative intent then is found in articulations by the constructors of the language, and then the vote that either affirmative or, it would be affirmative if it becomes a law, based on the testimony and the intention being articulated by the author.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I was going to make that point. I think I've been very clear about what the intent of this bill is for. I think the testifiers have also affirmed and been very clear about what the intent of this bill is for. I will also offer, Representative Lucero, that you may withdraw your amendment and we can move forward with the bill as is.
Fair enough. Representative Novotny. You might be muted, sir.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I'm going to try to switch back to my previous page here. But just a question for the author on the language. And since the language is what I'm speaking about, I want to make sure that we're on the same page. So just as a clarification on line 111 of your amendment, after describing, you know, what a white supremacist is, line 11, it's comma, or seek to exacerbate racial and ethnic tensions between BIPOC and non-BIPOC. So the question here for the author is that anyone that engages in trying to separate those two groups, would anybody then by that definition be considered a white supremacist?
Representative Frazier.
No, Representative Novotny, that is not the intent.
Representative Novotny.
Well, that's why, as Representative Lucero was pointing out, having enforced statute and coming up with charging documents. That's the kind of thing that I think we need to clear up in your amendment is if you're going to make an allegation for one group to do, you know, you're making this label, but by your definition, if you just read it for what's there, that's not what it says.
Very well. Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is to the amendment to the amendment. The first question that I've got is on line, the question is on line 1.10, and it says that white people are superior to black, comma, indigenous, and people of color, which we now define as BIPOC. Could the author please explain the difference between a capitalization of the word black, a capitalization of the word indigenous, and the lowercase use of the word white, which is also found in line 1.8, please?
Representative Frazier.
There is no particular meaning other than the emphasis on those particular communities. Representative Riley, thank you for that question.
Very well. Representative Lowe.
Mr. Chair, I'm still waiting for you to call back on me.
Oh, I'm sorry. You had another question. You did say that. I apologize.
Yes, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for correcting the chair and calling that out. Would the author please take a look at I've got another point of this one is I did a search on all of the statutes from the 1851 territorial statutes to the 2020 Minnesota statutes, and I looked for the spelling of white as it relates to either capitalization or lowercase. I was able to find in section 169.202 the definition of white canes as it relates to the blind utilizing a white cane. 469.088 defines White Bear Lake. 253B.212 tells us about the White Earth Band, and part 626.2.0800 defines white fish. Could the author please point us to the definition of the word white, please?
Representative Raleigh, I don't think it's the author's intent to describe an all-inclusive definition of the word white.
Mr. Chair, if I may then, as a follow-up to that, to your clarification, we had testifiers that said that there are white extremists, white nationalists, white supremacists, and it was told to us in testimony that the number one domestic terrorist is white, and then fill in one of those is either a supremacist.
Mr. Chair, I have to comment to this. This is ridiculous.
Hold on. Representative Raleigh, can you please get to the point?
Absolutely. We're defining various races, and it says in your amendment that that ethnic tensions between BIPOC and non-BIPOC or engage in patently hateful or inflammatory speech, intimidation and violence against BIPOC, but it does not state anything in the reverse. And so the clear definition of a word has to be in the statutes and in this, if it becomes law, this will become the law of the land. And an interpretation by a court based off of our testimony today and based off of what is being meant by these words absolutely have long-ranging effects. Because, again, I'm going back to the testimony that we received today, and I appreciate all the testimony, but if white supremacy is the number one, I wrote it down, the number one domestic threat, then why does the FBI list Bahadur Kashmir Chalani Patel, Alejandro Rosales Castillo, and I can list the other that are listed there, as the top 10 most wanted? And yet I don't see anywhere on the FBI list that they list fentanyl or they list COVID or any others as the number one.
Raleigh,
yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Please, sir. This could probably go on for quite a while. The author was quite intentional and clear from the beginning that this legislation addresses, in fact, a category of people and behaviors that the federal government itself has identified as the number one threat, a domestic threat, as you cited. He's using the exact same descriptors that you're going to find in those FBI reports that our testifiers did identify. But Representative Frazier, please, a quick addition that I want to move on.
Just quickly, I think this is Representative Riley. Thank you for those comments and for those questions. Just quickly, this is a very serious issue. We lost law enforcement officers on January 6th. We're losing community members due to white supremacy. I want us to move forward in a thoughtful and intentional way to let our community know that it's very important that our law enforcement is there to serve everyone equally with vigor.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Frazier. Thank you, Representative Riley. These are tough conversations, and I totally appreciate probing one another in terms of what our intent and clarity, because we are, in fact, making law. So I appreciate the opportunity to do that. Representative Long, and then members will get up. Oh, Representative O'Neill, if I can get to you, but Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I just wanted to respond to two quick points. First, the Associated Press capitalizes both Black and Indigenous, but not white, and they have a very good explanation of why they do that. And they explain that Black and Indigenous share history, identity, and community, and that white individuals do not. And so that's why they've made that decision. I wanted to also respond to Representative Lucero's questions. I think that the reading that Representative Lucero was giving to the amendment to the amendment was missing a key word, and that word was "and," which promote white supremacy and promote religious and racial bigotry. So if read in context, I think it's very clear that racial bigotry on its own was not the author's intent, that it must be combined with promoting white supremacy. And I'll note that white supremacist groups have a long history of religious discrimination, including against people of the Jewish faith and others. So I think the intent's clear if it's read in context. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well, members. We're almost out of time. We have the Representative Frazier's motion to amend the A1 amendment with the A2 amendment. The clerk will take the roll on the vote. Clerk will take the roll.
Mr. Chair, are we taking the roll on every? I don't think there's a roll to be called, I guess.
Representative Lucero, I am advised that in this platform it is best for us to do that. Thank you for the clarification. Clerk will take the roll on the A2 amendment.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Chair Mariani, I believe that was Representative Poston.
You know, I thought that didn't sound like Representative
Poston. Well, thank you, Chair.
Representative Poston, we're in the middle of a roll.
No, I know. I'm confused about what we're voting on, Chair. Is this the amendment to the amendment?
That's appropriate, Representative Poston. We are voting on the A2 amendment to the A1 amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier? Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Johnson, no. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Feist, aye. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Hewitt, aye.
Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Lucero, no. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Mueller, no. Representative Novotny?
No.
Novotny, no. Representative O'Neill?
No. A very problematic definition, and I didn't get to speak again.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
No.
Poston, no. Representative Raleigh?
No.
Raleigh, no. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Zhang, aye. And that's 11 ayes and 7 nays.
And a vote of 11 ayes, 7 nays, the A2 amendment to the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Lucero, moves adoption of the A1 amendment as amended. The clerk will take the vote.
Mr. Chair, I was going to final comments.
Representative Lucero, we frankly do not have time. It's appropriate to either withdraw your amendment or just, you know, continue with the roll at this point. Those are the
ones. Yes, I'll have to take the floor then.
All right. We'll see you there. The clerk will take the roll on the A1 amendment as adopted.
Chair Mariani?
As amended, I meant. Aye.
Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson? Representative Johnson, aye. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Feist, aye. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Aye.
Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Lucero, no. Representative Mueller?
As amended, no.
Mueller, no. Representative Novotny?
As amended, no.
Novotny, no. Representative O'Neill?
As amended, no, and still very problematic. Terrible definition.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
No.
Poston, no. Representative Raleigh? Representative Raleigh?
No.
Raleigh, no. Representative Vang?
Aye.
Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Zhang, aye. 12 ayes, 6 nays.
On a vote of 12 ayes and 6 nays, the A1 amendment, as amended, is adopted. Representative Frazier renews his motion that House or makes his motion that House File 593, as amended, be referred to the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
Aye.
Mariani, aye. Vice Chair Frazier?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frazier, aye. Representative Johnson?
No.
Johnson, no. Representative Edelson?
Aye.
Edelson, aye. Representative Feist?
Aye.
Feist, aye. Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Hollins, aye. Representative Hewitt?
Hewitt, aye.
Hewitt, aye. Representative Cleavorn?
Cleavorn, aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Representative Long?
Aye.
Long, aye. Representative Lucero?
No.
Lucero, no. Representative Mueller?
Mueller votes no.
Mueller, no. Representative Novotny?
No.
Novotny, no. Representative O'Neill?
Not after it's been amended, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Poston?
No.
Poston, no. Representative Raleigh?
No.
Raleigh, no. Representative Vang?
Is there a second opinion?
Vang, aye. Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Zhang, aye. 11 ayes, 7 nays.
Members, on a vote of 11 ayes and 7 nays, the House File 593, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Members, we will meet again tomorrow. At our regular time at 10:30 a.m. We have 4 bills before us, including the Gomez bill, House File 640, regarding Citizen Oversight Council, similar to a bill that this committee passed last year, House File 75, Mueller on forfeiture, limitations on forfeiture, House File 237, a QAM bill that we also heard and passed in this committee last year on confidential informants. And then I'll have a small bill regarding the advisory council we created in the Pulse Board in last year's Minnesota Police Accountability Act. So members, until that time, this committee stands adjourned.